Chapter 13. They advised Giles to return to his hotel and wait to be contacted. The equipment specified for the test setup consisted of a number of specialty items generally unnecessary at the lab. There was a lead time to acquire much of it, especially the shield, which required the double-slit aperture to be custom-cut at a 10-micron gap. Kevin assured him they were hunting each item aggressively, sticking with local sources wherever possible, so that items could be hand-carried back to the lab if needed. Despite their efforts, it might be as much as a week before a working test rig was constructed, not counting the time needed to punch up a MATLAB project to analyze the results, so he should probably sit tight a while. He talked the matter over with Annalise, and they finally agreed to spend the remainder of the week seeing as much as they could together. She would fly home on Saturday, leaving him behind to finish what he had started, after which he would follow her. It was a small matter for them. She was used to his business trips, especially on city installations. It seemed there were always greater challenges demanding of his personal attention in such deployments. While it was true that he found long periods of time without her to be difficult, he supposed a week or so was manageable. He tried at first to hide his unease, but she teased it out, of course, the way wives always do. For a time, he resisted explanation, writing his periods of silence off as the general tension he always felt when he had a big project waiting for him. She smelled this for the lie it was, but understood he would not bother hiding unless something was troubling him deeply, and let it go. He finally opened up to her, as she knew he would, in the middle of Ellis Island's Great Hall, among the chorus of 1,000 tourists, sounds of footsteps and jumbled conversations rebounding from rust-tiled floor to herringbone ceiling. They stood facing each other between two giant American flags, and Giles said, "I guess they looked before they leaped."
"Hmm?"
Anna asked. "The people who were processed here. They drove toward this country on the sails of an unformed promise. Not even a promise, a chance. A chance things would work out. I'm beginning to think that I understand how it must have been." She wanted to press him, but refrained from doing so. In time, her patience was rewarded. "I think I've made a hell of a gamble, Anna. I've been trying very hard not to dwell on it, but I think I may have put things at real risk."
"What things?"
"My career. My name. I've advocated for a rather unique test. A test that seemed almost to be the answer to a prayer, purpose made for proving the very thing I've been seeking. And when I latched onto it, I did so with both hands and all my teeth, and never once considered the source. And now I'm in too deep to turn around."
"I don't understand, Giles. Tell me."
He did. And when he finished, she was a long time in responding. Finally, she asked,
"Should you be back at the hotel working more on this? Looking for alternate methods?"
"No, it's no good. I've already put everything I have behind this. Anagnorisis has mobilized its whole procurement department to get me the things I need. I can't call them up now and ask them to try something else. They're liable to shut me down entirely. And aside from that, I've been looking. Nothing else has yet been devised that gets me what I need."
"And what is it exactly that you need?"
"Time. I need a hard number that I can take to that group of people that causes them to delay long enough for me to find a better methodology." Anna nodded and took his hand, leading away from the hall's center.
"What happens if this test turns out to be bunk?"
"I can't even afford to consider that."
"You have to, Giles. What if?"
He sighed, rolled his neck around in great crackling circles, and looked out a window. He looked beyond the window and out into the water, as if he had left his heart out there somewhere, and searched for it. "There's only one way this can go right, and God knows how many it could go wrong. They've given me enough time to run a few control tests, as well as an equal number of runs against Cronus.
What about including a few human subjects?"
He shook his head.
"Waste of time. So far as any of us have found, NOAC's results have yet to be replicated by an independent research group. If I bring human subjects in, I need to bring in a statistically significant population. In essence, I would be validating the original study while testing Cronus at the same time. I just don't have the time for that. They won't give it to me. I have one last session to come up with something. And after that, they pull the plug. They're losing a ton of money in delays right now. I can't even imagine how many programs they have on hold while I figure this out. and that media leak has spooked the hell out of them. They want it over and done. I can tell that about half of them wish they'd never gone outside the organization for this, so... yeah, that's where I'm at. It's a Hail Mary to see if I can get a number big enough to make an impact. Something that will prove to them, and me, that this is worth pushing. It sounds like you've allowed yourself to be set up to fail, she said. He nodded. That's so. Then refuse to work according to these terms. Back out. No, he sighed. It might be real, Anna. Cronus might be real. There are a lot of things I've accepted in the last few years that I'm not too happy about. Not too proud of. I don't like what they've done with my work. I don't like what it's been turned into, and I don't like how they've come after us for it. And despite all that, I've kept working on it because it's a big, sexy program, and it's put us in this lifestyle. I've been thinking about that a lot. Thinking about how a man sells himself for comfort. It's not a decision that comes fast, Anna. You don't ever come to a crossroads one day and say, this is where I'll throw away who I said I was for the low things I truly care about. It happens slow. So slow you can't even see it coming. It's just one day you turn around and see where you've gone, and you realize. You've sold yourself like a whore, a dollar and an inch at a time. He turned away from her so she would not see him wipe at his eyes. I see it coming this time, too. Maybe because I've gotten so good at it, I don't know. It would be so easy to walk away and go back to how it was. Anagnorisis would release some kind of statement, I'd go back to my life and nobody need know a thing about it. But it might be the real thing. I can't prove it, but I think there is the possibility, and if I walk away from that, I'll think about that for the rest of my life. Anna kissed her husband and wrapped her arms around him and held on to him for a long time. She said, do what you need to do. Do what you can live with. And then come home. Giles told her he would try. Kevin had estimated around 20 protesters outside the lab on that first day. When the driver pulled up to the front gate, Giles counted a number somewhat larger. They bunched up by the gate in a vast multicolored cluster, many sitting in camping chairs under umbrellas. He saw the signs, though he was too far away to read them, and he was impressed by the group's lassitude. They perched under the shelter of the umbrellas and surrounding trees like wilting flowers, some chatting silently. When the car approached, many perked up to take notice, and when they realized the car meant to pass through the gate, they mobilized as if they had all been caught sleeping on the job. Several of the heavier ones struggled to stand from their chairs like overturned crabs, and Giles thought that they might be better served protesting all-you-can-eat restaurant specials. They could not know for sure he was in the car. The windows had been tinted to opacity. But they howled at the car and made as if to strain against the police holding them back. They did not appear to Giles to strain very hard. The car drifted through the mall, and glancing out his window, he saw a picture of his own face on a red placard over the words, "He's watching you." He wanted to get out of the car and scream right back at them, but then the gate locked shut, saving him from himself. He exited the car without even a goodbye for the driver and crossed to the front entrance in half a dozen steps. When he entered the building, he was met with what appeared to be the entire executive team of Anagnorisis Technologies, all standing in a line and staring back at him. Their smiles were warm enough, but their eyes held a gleam as lustrous as old paste jewelry. They made him feel like a reptile in a terrarium. Kevin Roth stood apart from the group and did not smile. He seemed somber. He might have been preparing himself to go view a body. Giles appreciated that expression and wondered if he would get a chance to thank Kevin for it later on. He went over to meet him. They nodded to each other, and Kevin stole a moment to glance at the others before asking, "You ready?" Giles said that he was, struggling to put as much confidence into his voice as he could, and then said, "I wasn't expecting such an audience here today." "You mean the zealots outside or the gathering in here?" A trick of his own mind convinced Giles that Kevin had said, "Or the zealots in here." He nodded distractedly and said, "Yes." Not realizing the answer was unspecific. Kevin assumed it was a joke and laughed. His laugh came easily. "They're here because they don't want to wait for an answer. You have today until the close of business, and then this is all done. The decision will be based on whatever you recommend. If you say there's something there that needs further evaluation, that's what they'll do. There's a short list of names already, and the calls will go out this evening. But, well, I think you understand the situation, don't you? You want to make damn sure there's something there, Giles. For everyone's sake, okay? He paused for a moment, staring into Giles's eyes, waiting, and Giles nodded. Kevin nodded back, and buried behind the wall of his practiced confidence was a whole story, beginning, middle, and end, that Giles lacked the art to read. Marcus has overseen the configuration of the equipment you suggested, and the analytic program is set to run automatically. You need only click the play button, and the rest will take care of itself. Thank you, Giles said. May I go back now? Kevin walked to the back of the lobby and held the door open. Giles had not brought his computer or his phone along, so he followed directly after. He glanced at the receptionist to nod and perhaps smile as he passed the front desk, but saw it was now stationed by a man he did not recognize. The door shut behind him, and he plunged through the cubicle farm, ignoring the eyes that peeked around the partitions to follow his progress. He continued through and beyond, past the adjoining doors, down the hallway, and arrived at the door to the shielded chamber. Marcus stood in the hall waiting for him. He wondered what he would say to Marcus as he closed the distance. Wondered if their interaction would be professional, or strained, or awkward. Giles opened his mouth to speak, but Marcus cut across his words like a scythe. The test bed has been configured to the specifications provided, and I have explained the rudiments of the procedure to Cronus to save time. It should have some working knowledge of what is required. Thank you, Mr. Gennaro, Giles said formally. He reached for the door handle, but Marcus stopped him with a gesture. You know, you're taking a hell of a risk on this. And the test itself? Preposterous. I've reviewed your career up to this point. In fact, I was part of the group that brought you in. You're no dummy. At least I thought you weren't. What is this? Some kind of ego thing? You're so convinced that this cannot be? Giles asked. Mr. Guittery, I haven't the foggiest idea where our consciousness comes from or how it got there except to say that it is inherent to our souls. We are because God has made us so, I truly believe that. There's a profound mystery buried within, and the wonder of that mystery is the source of divinity. There is no mystery beyond that door. I know every inch of that machine, top to bottom, and there is no part of its function that is mysterious. It is only complex, and it is that very complexity that seems to have undone you. Giles considered this a moment and replied, The existence of God, supposed or real, does not rule out the creation of a new being, Marcus, just as the study of physics and cosmology does not rule out the presence of God. You remind me of an angel that looked at man and questioned God his sanity. Could it be that you're the one here with an ego thing? He stepped through the door before Marcus could respond. There was a new guard on the other side, just as there had been in the lobby. He regarded Giles with an unfriendly eye and directed him through the process of being scanned. Then Giles was through the portal and inside the steel chamber with the sensory apparatus. Welcome back, Giles. Hello, Cronus. I trust you're well? I am as I always am. Are you well? Giles smiled. I will be if this works. The overhead track began to slide up the length of the laboratory, bringing the suspended body up the aisle. There was that period of adaptation Giles must undergo, the interval that must transpire before his eyes cease to know the worm-geared crane arm and see only the body. Cronus halted at a lab bench and gestured with his hand. Giles followed the gesture and saw that the coffee maker was still there on the bench, along with his cup and a jug of water. Would you like coffee, Giles? Yes, but I'll make it myself. He walked to the bench, lifted the lid on the maker, and began to prepare the reservoir. You do not wish me to make it? No. Why? Giles closed the lid and considered. Because I don't know if it is appropriate. He pressed a button, and the machine began to gurgle. As it worked, he crossed the floor to the test station's computer monitor and reviewed the GUI that had been cobbled together. Cronus floated up behind him to look over his shoulder. A relatively simple setup. The entry fields below allow you to set the duration during which recording occurs and which it does not. Giles nodded. That's good. I'll run a few control cycles while I work on that coffee. He punched in a few numbers. Then he went to the long table where the components had been assembled and applied power to the laser and line camera. He clicked the play button on the computer as the coffee maker sputtered its last, and he cradled the cup in his hands as he watched the system cycle. Cronus, you're not focusing on the test at this time, correct? Not in the way you mean, Giles. I am contemplating its nature at this time. I am not focusing on the aperture. Good. He blew on his coffee and burned his tongue anyway. You're contemplating it, though? Yes, I am contemplating the test's relevancy. You doubt it as well, then? I do not know if doubt is a condition I am capable of experiencing, as I do not know what it means to you to doubt. Given what I have been able to discover from the available literature, I will say that this test does not seem to have been subjected to the generally accepted levels of scientific rigor. This does not make the test less likely to function as expected. It only means that we collectively do not know if it will. Giles sighed and took another sip. I certainly couldn't put it any better myself. If it does not work, what will you do? I don't know. Do you have no other plan? Is there no other evidence you can provide? I need to see something concrete, Cronus, to recommend further pursuit. I understand the dubiousness of this test, but this has the potential to yield a strong, undeniable result. If the underlying supposition is correct, if I can show that consciousness does in fact impact the physical world, if I can produce cold, hard data that demonstrates this is so... Giles trailed off into silence, and Cronus said nothing more. The control cycle ran for an hour. When it was finished, the computer issued a gentle chime, and they both approached the monitor to read the results. A spectral power chart filled the screen, stretched out over the horizontal plane to denote time, and a cluster of dots was displayed running all along the center zero line. They were not perfectly aligned at zero, which pleased Giles. If they had been so, he would have had to call the entire configuration into question. The results seemed reasonable to him, all aligned at or just off zero sigma. The minute randomness of their placement suggested that the system ran true. He clicked a button to save these results to file as a baseline, and then turned to look at Cronus. Are you ready? Yes. Is there some particular way this should be done? Giles pointed at the aperture line camera enclosure and said, Only that you must conceptualize the double slit within this box and focus your attention on one of the slits. It doesn't matter which, just choose one and prefer it over the other. You must desire the photons to pass through only one. I will choose the right slit. Fair enough, Giles said. He spent a few seconds over the computer to reset the test, and then glanced back at Cronus again. Cronus looked at him and nodded, a gesture so natural it sent chills down Giles's spine. He clicked the start button and watched as the black lenses of Cronus's eyes turned back to the test enclosure, and then the body was motionless. Giles backed away slowly from the computer, sat down at a lab bench, and waited. His heart hammered at its ribcage, threatening to break it apart. The test ran as if it had been designed for a human subject, with periods of focus divided by periods of rest. Cronus continued to watch the enclosure during the rest periods, and Giles continued to ask him on each cessation if he had stopped concentrating. After the third repetition of this question, Cronus began to look up at the ceiling during rest periods. Giles was satisfied by the visual cue and began to watch the shower of numbers falling down the computer screen. He focused on these, trying to pick out some pattern of numbers suggesting a waveform collapse, but saw only digital noise. He wondered if it was something Cronus could do. Probably not. Their interactions suggested that Cronus processed his surrounding world at the same speed as his human counterparts. It was a common assumption in the old science fiction. The idea that the artificial entity could think at speeds so rapid as to render the biological entity static by comparison. They seemed never to account for or understand that a classical computer could only perform a single computation at a time, while the human brain processed the entire environment holistically in a constant incoming stream of sensory data. It seemed to Giles as if the dreamers of the genre took the miraculous nature of humanity for granted, discounting the raw power of such a system out of basic familiarity. Cronus was, in essence, a machine, and yet the chief processor of that machine had been built closer to the mind of man than anything else in human history, as close as they could achieve with their limited self-understanding. Like man, different to him only in that his very being was composed of metals, plastics, electrons, carbon, and light, rather than liquids, proteins, and nucleic acids. Giles imagined the core of the machine's brain sprawling out beneath the floor, consuming a measure of cubic feet at which he could only guess, and the body that silently shared the room with him. And he considered all that had gone into making something capable of the abilities with which he had been naturally born. Giles felt the wild urge to ask Cronus if time could feel slow or fast depending on what it was doing, but did not wish to distract from its task. He let the first cycle run for 2 hours, diverting his attention between the wall of scrolling numbers and the web browser on a nearby lab computer, perusing links to kill time. He read separate words out of context and gave up. When the test completed, he nearly bounded to the computer and waited for the results to collate. Another spectral power graph was displayed, this time spanning a time frame much longer than before, and along its length, a sprawling collection of dots at zero sigma. Cronus's observation had yielded no effect on the interference pattern. He stared at the screen for a long time, failing to process the information his eyes conveyed. Then he fiddled with the mouse, attempted to zoom in the view to find some button to refresh it, and scrolled along the graph. No matter what he did, the data points refused to change. He drew in breath, but when he tried to speak, nothing happened. It all just came out in a wheeze. "What does it mean, Giles?" Cronus asked. He shook his head. Nothing happened. He went over the setup, examined all of the cables and contacts, the power inputs, and then explored the test computer's interface until he found the image generated by line camera feed in a background window. It showed a grayscale interference pattern under a small flashing green light. He moved over to the test bed, found the power input to the camera enclosure, and killed it. On the test computer, the flashing green light was replaced with a solid red light. Giles turned the line camera back on and then killed power to the laser. The grayscale interference pattern on the test computer was replaced by a solid black bar beneath a flashing green light. When he applied power, the interference pattern returned.
"It all seems to be working," Giles muttered.
"I assure you I am focusing as you have requested."
"Yes, I know," he said shortly.
He tapped his fingers on the benchtop, thinking. "Shall we try again?" Giles eventually shrugged.
"I suppose. Let me restart everything from scratch."
He walked to the test bed and shut all of the hardware off. Then he went to the computer, noted the name of the project file that was loaded, and rebooted the system. As they waited for the computer to come back, Cronus said,
"So far it does not look good."
"No.
It seems convoluted.
As a human, the only proof you are required to give for the existence of you is to simply exist. I wonder why it is that I should be held to a higher standard."
"Extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof," Giles said.
"I do not find my condition to be an extraordinary claim."
"I imagine not, but the people who must decide about these things do."
"Are you not the person who must decide, Giles?"
Giles said nothing in response.
"It would seem that this experiment is lacking in extraordinary proof."
"Let's just try it again," Giles said.
"What if the result is the same?"
Giles clenched his hand and released it slowly and did not respond.
After the computer had finished booting, Giles loaded the test program, initiated another cycle, and allowed it to run for another hour. The results of the second run were the same as the first, with the exception of three distinct cycles showing deviates at or around 2. This excited Giles the way a fisherman is excited when the tip of his pole dips toward the water, and he urged Cronus headlong into several more cycles. None of them produced results any better than 2, and most showed chance across the board. At 2 o'clock, Giles believed those initial spikes were an aberration. He told Cronus to take a break and went through the process of power cycling the entire system again. When the test computer had booted fully, he said, "I'm going to run the test with myself as a subject for a while."
"Do you now seek to demonstrate your own consciousness, Giles?"
He scoffed. "Was that a joke?"
"Things are not actually funny, Giles."
"No, of course not. I'm just trying to see if I can make the system do something new.
I see. You have given up, then?
No.
I don't know. I don't know what I am, Cronus.
He started the test and focused on the enclosure for all he was worth. He thought hard about the left slit of the aperture, straining until his chest felt tight and his throat thick, until his neck began to ache with tension. He rested dutifully when the rest periods came, and when they were finished, he focused. He focused like a man searching for the meaning of all things. The end of the test cycle came sooner than he had expected, and as he watched the data begin to collate on the screen, he realized he had broken into a sweat. He dabbed at his forehead, and the screen filled with a spectral power graph, and all along its length were a line of data points clustered at zero sigma.
"What does it mean?" Cronus asked.
"I don't know." "I don't know," Giles whispered. His chest still felt tight, and his throat still felt thick.
"I don't know," he repeated.
Slowly, he rose from the chair and began to shut down the test bed. He glanced at Cronus, who stared back intently, and said,
"I'd better go speak with them."
He began to walk toward the exit but was halted when Cronus called to him.
"Giles,
you said you required some form of concrete evidence demonstrating that my consciousness affects matter."
"I did."
Cronus took Giles's coffee mug from the lab bench and hurled it across the room. It flew in a shallow arc, streaming a lazy spiral of brown droplets, and shattered when it impacted the steel panel of the far wall. The black lenses regarded Giles, motionless. The body had been vacated. The guard led Giles to a conference room at the other end of the hall. He found Kevin Roth inside, sitting at the far end of the table, hunched over his laptop. Kevin looked up as he entered, pulled out his phone, called someone, and said, "Bring everyone back, he's here." Giles sat down at the center of the long table facing the door and waited. Within 5 minutes, Linnea Nilsson, Marcus Gennaro, Ross Dyer, Jennifer Baer, and a whole gaggle of well-dressed satellites filtered into the room and settled into chairs. They looked at him expectantly, but said nothing. He looked around the room, glanced down at the tabletop, and said, "The results are inconclusive."
"Inconclusive?" Kevin asked.
"Obviously," grunted Marcus.
Giles waited until they finished and then said, "I ran several test cycles. The results of each cycle scored at or close to chance. I reviewed the physical setup of the test, from the laser through to the camera feed, and found it to be correct. I also ran the test against myself as a subject and got the same results as when Cronus did it himself."
He heard a snort and chose not to look up.
"Meaning?" Linnea asked.
There are three possibilities. The test was conducted improperly, the underlying hypothesis is incorrect, or Cronus is simply a complex machine and nothing more."
"Fine," said Marcus.
"In that case, I would like to review the test computer's code," Giles interrupted.
This was met with silence at first. Suspiciously, Marcus asked,
"To what end?"
Giles took a heavy breath and wondered just how far he was willing to plunge. "I would like to review the logic employed for converting the interference pattern recorded by the line camera into a measure of spectral power."
Marcus leaned forward, laid his hands flat on the table, and said,
"You want to do a code review now? Is this some sort of a joke?"
"I was able to review and validate every other aspect of the testbed," said Giles. "The graphing logic is the only part I didn't look at. It's the only way I feel to rule out any possible oversights in the test setup."
"Oversights?"
Giles met Marcus's gaze head-on and said, "It's no secret that you were opposed to the process from the beginning." There were a number of exhalations around the room, not quite gasps. Giles concurred. It was a pathetic attempt, and yet he felt he now grasped at strands. Marcus Gennaro stood from his chair, glowering at Giles as if he were a patch of filth to be scrubbed away. Linnea said, "Hang on."
"Bullshit,"
Marcus said, and then laughed. He laughed, but his smile was cruel.
"Bullshit. I'm done with this, ladies and gentlemen. Enough of my time has been wasted on this little circus. If you all want to continue on with the crystal worshiper over there, that's on you."
"Marcus," Kevin whispered.
"No,"
he laughed.
"No. This man is a clown. He is a clown, and I have had enough."
He left the room, and they heard his laughter diminish down the hallway. Giles looked at the others in the room and saw that he had lost them all. Kevin only shook his head sadly, as if Giles had just been diagnosed with a terminal illness, and said, "Giles, I'll just say this the one time. Marcus didn't do what you're insinuating. He and I have worked together a very long time. He can be a pain, sure enough. But he would not do that." There was a chorus of embarrassed noise, of clearing throats and shifting bodies. "Now, putting that aside, what is your finding? Given what you've seen here today, do you recommend further investigation?" Giles looked down at his hands, pressed flat over the tabletop, and muttered something. "I beg your pardon, we couldn't hear." "I said I cannot. No." Kevin leaned back in his chair, glanced at the others, and nodded. "Give us a few minutes, please. We'll need to discuss what happens next. You can wait out in the lobby if that's all right." Giles cleared his throat, stood slowly, and thanked them all. He walked back to the lobby, past the peering eyes of the cubicle farm, past the unfamiliar guard, and sat in a chair to wait. It took them 15 minutes to decide to send Giles home.